Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Welcome to a History of the Space Race podcast, episode 74, Apollo 15. In July 1971, the Apollo program came into full maturity with the launch of Apollo 15. Apollo 15 was the first of the J-type missions. So, whereas Apollo 11 was a G-type mission to just demonstrate that a manned landing could be performed, and Apollos 12, 13, and 14 were H-type missions to demonstrate precision landings on the moon, the J-type mission finally expanded the focus on scientific exploration rather than focusing on an engineering or technical feat. The J-type missions would also see longer stays on the lunar surface and more equipment being brought with the lunar module to enable greater scientific exploration. For example, the time on the moon would be extended from a maximum of 2 days during the G and H-type missions to a maximum of 3 days during the J-type missions. The number of EVAs would also be doubled from the typical 2 EVAs in the prior missions to 4 EVAs. The astronauts were also issued upgraded spacesuits that were easier to mount and allowed greater range of motion. To expand the scope of exploration on the lunar surface, a lunar rover carried on the lunar module would also be available to the astronauts. A lunar rover for the Apollo program had been considered as early as 1960, but NASA did not issue any contract to build the rover until May 1969, when the launch of Apollo 10 made it fairly clear that the primary objective of landing astronauts on the moon would be accomplished. The lunar rover was limited to being no heavier than 500 pounds and had to fit in a space that was only 5 feet by 20 inches. The rover ultimately developed was capable of moving at about 6 to 8 miles per hour. The expanded duration and additional equipment carried during the G-type missions was possible only because NASA made serious modifications to the lunar module itself. The amount of fuel and oxidizer carried by the lunar module had to be expanded, and solar power cells were added to provide more electrical power, among other changes. In total, this made the lunar modules used for the J-type missions about 10 to 15% heavier than previous lunar modules. Originally, NASA did not plan to launch a J-type mission until Apollo 16. Due to budget cuts, however, NASA decided to begin the J-type mission one launch earlier with Apollo 15 to enable more scientific research. This meant that the lunar module originally slated for Apollo 15, which was the lighter version of the lunar module designed only for a 2-day stay on the moon, became excess equipment. That lunar module is now on display at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. So, if you want to set your eyes on the only man-rated lunar module in existence on Earth, that's where you can see it. The National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. has another lunar module, but the one in D.C. was never man-rated. It was intended for a second unmanned test of the lunar module that was canceled after the first unmanned test was a success. The crew chosen for Apollo 15 included Commander David Scott, Lunar Module Pilot James Irwin, and Command Module Pilot Alfred Warden. Scott was an experienced astronaut, having flown with Neil Armstrong on Gemini 8 when they lost control of the spacecraft due to a stuck thruster, and on Apollo 9 during the testing of the command and lunar modules in Earth orbit. For Irwin and Warden, Apollo 15 would be their first time in space. Both had been recruits from the fifth class of astronauts in 1966. As for the spacecraft call signs, Scott chose Endeavour for the name of the command module. The command module was named after the HMS Endeavour, the ship that explored Australia and New Zealand under the command of James Cook. Scott chose the name Endeavour because Cook's mission had been primarily a scientific voyage, and Apollo 15 as the first J-type mission was similarly to have a primarily scientific emphasis. The lunar module was named Falcon after the U.S. Air Force mascot, since Scott had served in the Air Force. The mission plan for Apollo 15 called for landing near the Hadley Rill, a rill being a depression in the shape of a channel or a line. Hadley Rill is located near the middle of the moon in an upper latitude. Hadley Rill had been selected for the primary landing site due to scientific interest in the rough terrain and its proximity to the Apennine Mountains. Hadley Rill did have some significant drawbacks as a landing site. Because the site was so close to the Apennine Mountains, the trajectory for landing would have to be steeper than all other Apollo landings. The astronauts would also have to plan the mission and the landing without the benefit of any high-resolution satellite photos of the area. Because of the rough terrain, the area had not been identified as an acceptable landing site for one of the earlier Apollo missions. So, high-resolution photos of this area were never collected by the lunar orbiter or surveyor probes. Unlike Alan Shepard and Edgar Mitchell, who were not at all enthusiastic about the scientific aspects of their mission for Apollo 14, Scott and Irwin were excited about the science for Apollo 15. Scott, in particular, was eager to gather as much scientific data as possible and began his geology lessons early. It also helped that Scott was genuinely interested in geology. To ensure that he was adequately prepared, he took a geological field trip on Earth about once a month for the 20 months leading up to the launch. Through these field trips, he learned to describe geological features in ways that would be helpful to people who could not see what he was seeing. This way, geologists back on Earth could help guide him to interesting features on the moon when they were outside the range of a camera. On July 26, 1971, Apollo 15 took off for the moon. To compensate for the heavier lunar module on this launch, Mission Control flew the Saturn V rocket on a slightly different trajectory. With more confidence after several successful missions, the number of retro rockets used to separate the first stage S1C had also been reduced to lighten the launch vehicle. NASA had also reduced the amount of fuel reserved on the Saturn V to lighten the rocket even more. The journey to the moon went largely as planned, with only a few minor problems. After performing the translunar injection maneuver to head to the moon, Warden conducted the transposition maneuver, and Endeavour and Falcon docked successfully. The third stage of the Saturn V, the S4B, was then remotely directed to fly toward the moon, where it would crash to provide data for the seismometers placed on the moon's surface during previous landings. The first minor problem occurred on the journey to the moon. A malfunction light turned on, showing a possible problem with the service module engine. Since the service module engine was the main engine for maneuvering, this presented a potentially serious problem. The malfunction light suggested that the main engine could fire on its own unexpectedly. Mission Control suspected that this might just be an instrumentation problem and that the engine would work just fine. During the journey to the moon, the astronauts did fire the service module engine to correct their course and test the engine, and everything worked as expected. Later investigation confirmed that the malfunction light had turned on due to a tiny loose wire on the faulty signal switch. The second minor problem occurred as Scott and Irwin began to prepare the lunar module, Falcon. After opening the hatch between Endeavour and Falcon, they discovered broken bits of glass inside the lunar module. One of the covers on a display for rangefinding was broken. Because the display was supposed to be insulated in helium, there was a concern that the rangefinder wouldn't work now that it was exposed to the cabin atmosphere. Ground testing back on Earth, however, showed that the display would still work as expected. So Scott and Irwin proceeded, cleaning up the bits of glass with a vacuum and some tape. A third minor problem emerged 61 hours into the mission, as Apollo 15 neared the moon. The astronauts discovered a leak in their water system. This presented another potentially serious problem, but it was quickly addressed. The next problem was just mopping up the water in zero-g, and the astronauts had to place towels in the tunnel connecting the Endeavour and Falcon to try and dry out the area. The astronauts then encountered another, fourth, minor hitch when they tried to undock Falcon for the lunar landing. As with Apollo 14, the command module for Apollo 15 carried the lunar module into a lower orbit to help conserve fuel so that the lunar module would have more hover time when landing in a rough area of the lunar surface. After entering a lower orbit, with Scott and Irwin inside Falcon, Warden inside Endeavour tried to undock, but nothing happened. As it turned out, the umbilical cord used to transmit data between the two spacecraft through the docking probe had been unplugged. After plugging the cord back in, they successfully undocked, and Falcon started making its way to the lunar surface. As Falcon entered the powered descent phase of the landing, the minor problems started to pile up. There was now an error in the landing trajectory, so when Falcon pitched over and the astronauts could finally see the ground, they did not see any of the landmarks they had been trained to find during their simulations. Scott believed they were going to overshoot the landing site. As Falcon approached the surface for landing, lunar dust started to be kicked up earlier than in previous missions. This was actually because one of the modifications made to the heavier lunar module for the G-type missions was an extended engine bell, that cone that shapes around the exhaust from the rocket engine. Because of this modification to the engine, the engineers had also warned Scott that he should shut off the engine immediately after touchdown. If the engine kept running, lunar dust could get sucked into the engine and cause an explosion. So, when they were only 60 feet above the ground, the exhaust started kicking up lunar dust, obscuring the windows. Operating only off of instruments now, Irwin shouted out that the contact light was on. This indicated that one of the long probes sticking out of the lunar lander's legs had touched the ground. As soon as the contact light turned on, Scott shut off the engine. This caused Falcon to fall the remaining about 1.5 feet to the lunar surface, causing the hardest landing of any Apollo mission. They also landed at a slight angle, leading to fears that the spacecraft would tip over. In the end, they were 1,800 feet from the planned landing site. Though, with the lunar rover available to Scott and Irwin, this actually didn't matter that much. After the landing, Scott and Irwin started preparing for a rest period before conducting their first EVA. But before doing so, Scott performed the first and only stand-up EVA on the moon. He did this by opening the hatch at the top of Falcon, the hatch normally used for docking with the command module. From there, Scott was able to look around the landing site from a high point and take some pictures. Scott insisted on conducting this stand-up EVA despite objections from Mission Control about the loss of oxygen from having to depressurize the cabin before opening the hatch. Scott had learned from his geological training that it was important to conduct an initial survey from a high point, and this stand-up EVA allowed Scott and Irwin to better plan their first surface EVA. Scott and Irwin then went to bed. During their sleep period, Mission Control learned of another minor problem in a series of minor problems that appear to crop up throughout the Apollo 15 mission. This time, Mission Control detected a loss of oxygen from the cabin and isolated the problem to an open valve in the urine transfer device. Mission Control did not consider the problem serious enough to wake the astronauts and told them to close the valve only after they awoke. After waking up, Scott and then Irwin exited Falcon and became the 7th and 8th humans to set foot on the moon. During the first surface EVA, Scott and Irwin focused on deploying their equipment. The first task was to pull out their lunar rover, which was a little difficult since Falcon had landed at an angle. After setting up the rover, they took it on a test drive to the Rill, then to Elbow Crater, and then to the Mons Hadley Delta. Attached to the rover was a low-resolution camera, which allowed geologists back on Earth to make some observations. At each site that they visited, Scott and Irwin collected samples and took photos before going back to the lunar module to finish deploying the Apollo Lunar Surface Experiments package. After about a 6.5-hour EVA, they headed back inside Falcon to rest. For the second surface EVA, Scott and Irwin drove back to the Mons Hadley Delta to collect more samples. Among the samples collected during this EVA was the Genesis Rock, so called because geologists thought that the rock was from the moon's primordial crust, meaning the crust before the moon fully solidified. But later analysis showed that the rock is slightly younger than the moon, so the moon had finished forming before this rock. But at an estimated 4 billion years old, the sample is still quite impressive. Scott and Irwin then went back to Falcon, where they raised the US flag and completed setting up the rest of the experiments package they did not complete during the first EVA. After about 7 hours, they went back inside Falcon for the next rest period. During the third and final surface EVA, Scott and Irwin stayed closer to Falcon. The main mission this time was to collect a core sample, which required hammering relatively deep into the surface, a process that took a substantial amount of time. In fact, Scott and Irwin had to cancel plans to drive to a group of nearby hills in order to finish getting the core sample. Before getting back into Falcon, Scott and Irwin also conducted more ceremonial and personal activities. First, Scott used a postal kit to cancel some first-day covers on stamps. Then he conducted an experiment in front of the camera, showing that without air resistance, a hammer and a feather fell to the ground at the same time. This proved Isaac Newton's theory that items with different masses fall at the same rate. Scott and Irwin then took a short drive on the rover to set up a camera away from Falcon, where the launch of the ascent stage could be filmed. After setting up the camera, while out of sight of the camera, Scott also left a small memorial, a statuette made of aluminum called the Fallen Astronaut, to commemorate all known astronauts and cosmonauts who had died thus far. NASA and Mission Control had no idea that Scott did this, and they would not know until after he came home. After almost 5 hours, the third EVA ended. On August 2, 1971, Falcon's ascent stage lifted off the lunar surface. After docking with the Endeavour, Scott and Irwin transferred their equipment and samples into the command module. Falcon was then jettisoned to crash on the lunar surface. The astronauts spent 2 more days in lunar orbit conducting science experiments and releasing a small satellite from the service module. On August 4th, Warden piloted Endeavour on a burn back to Earth. During the return, however, Warden got to establish a record of his own. He conducted an EVA to retrieve some film on the outside of the service module. This marked the first deep space EVA in history, being performed about 197,000 miles away from Earth. 3 days later, on August 7th, Endeavour splashed down in the Pacific Ocean, bringing Apollo 15 to an end. The significant emphasis on scientific exploration during the Apollo 15 mission managed to drum up some renewed interest in the Apollo program. It helped that the selected landing site had more interesting features than prior landing sites, giving television audiences something to look at. Apollo 15, however, would subsequently become mired in scandals after the mission's end. All of the scandals originated from the personal activities of the astronauts, which they had not disclosed to NASA. During Apollo 14, the astronauts had conducted some of their own activities, like Alan Shepard's golfing, Stuart Roos's moon trees, and Edgar Mitchell's ESP experiments. These activities were rather harmless. On Apollo 15, however, the personal activities of the astronauts created scandal because they created the image of financial impropriety. The first scandal broke when NASA learned that a stamp dealer had paid the astronauts $7,000 each to carry envelopes with stamps on the lunar module. When they returned to Earth, the astronauts gave 100 of these envelopes to the dealer, keeping another 300 envelopes to themselves. The dealer then tried to sell his share of the stamps for $1,500 apiece. NASA reprimanded Scott, Irwin, and Warden for a lapse of judgment because NASA had policies against profiting on the moon landings. Another scandal broke around the aluminum statuette, the fallen astronaut that Scott had left on the moon. Scott reported that he thought the statuette was intended to just be a memorial. The Belgian artist who made the statuette would receive no recognition and no money would be made off of it. The Belgian artist, however, had a different understanding, and he claimed that he thought he had an exclusive right to sell replicas of the memorial. NASA, because of its policy against commercial exploitation of the Apollo program, pressured the artist to cancel his plans to sell the replicas. You can see the one and only official replica today at the New York Met. With the Apollo 14 and Apollo 15 missions in 1971, the Apollo program reached maturity. By this time, NASA knew that there would be only two more landings on the moon due to budget cuts, and they would need to make the most of those missions. In the meantime, the Soviet Union's own plans for an immediate response to the Apollo moon landings was also taking shape. The plan to launch and man a space station in Earth orbit in the summer of 1971. This, however, will result in the only loss of life to ever occur in space. I'll talk about that more next time when I introduce Salyut 1.